From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with poet, editor, scholar, and musician Tony Trigilio about his new book, Proof Something Happened, which was the winner of the 2020 Marsh Hawk Press Poetry Prize. Tony Trigilio's other books include Ghosts of the Upper Floor and Inside the Walls of My Own House, both from Blaise Vox Books. His selected poems, Fuera del Taller del Cosmos, was published in Guatemala by Editorial Poe, translated by Boni Hernandez. And he co-edits the journal Court Green and is an associate editor for Tupelo Quarterly. Tony Trigilio lives in Chicago. Proof Something Happened is a book of poems based on a legendary UFO encounter, the story of Betty and Barney Hill, and an alien abduction they claimed happened to them when they were in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. The poet Susan Howe chose Proof Something Happened as the Marsh Hawk Poetry Prize winner in 2020 and writes, Tony Trigilio has plucked an early incident of ufology from the margins of 20th century cultural history, Betty and Barney Hill's close encounter, and created from a variety of documentary sources an original and highly resonant work of contemporary poetry. What comes into question in Proof Something Happened is how the imagination creates out of pervasive psychological tensions its own inner typology. Employing an open-ended poetics, Trigilio offers a range of angles from which to approach the Hills' alleged abduction, challenging us to take responsibility for why we yearn to believe, or if not, what to expect. Those are the words of Susan Howe. When I spoke with Tony Trigilio, I began by asking if we could just start out talking about the story behind the collection, Betty and Barney Hill's professed abduction by aliens on a September evening in 1961. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
The event that the book is based on took place in 1961, in September of 1961. Betty and Barney Hill, they lived in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They had taken a vacation to Montreal, and on their way back from Montreal, they had this very strange experience of looking up in the sky, and it looked like they were being followed by an object in the sky. They weren't sure what that object was. Barney was an experienced airplane watcher, so at first he thought it was a Piper Cub, the airplane, and then he realized pretty quickly it wasn't that. And then they started to get really scared because it was an object they couldn't identify, and they really did feel like they were being pursued.
Yeah.
And it became terrifying for them. And eventually they reached this period. They pulled off the road to try to get a better look. Barney was using his binoculars, and the binoculars come back to him frequently in hypnosis sessions and in therapy sessions. Like the binoculars became a really important object that he remembered. He was looking through the binoculars, and he allegedly, and I'll use the word allegedly as much as I can, although eventually I'll probably stop using the word allegedly just for the verisimilitude of it all.
But absolutely,
He allegedly saw a saucer-shaped craft through the binoculars with creatures looking out through the windows. The windows were wrapping around the saucer, and he could see that one of the creatures looked like the leader. And this was 1961. It wasn't that far from World War II. He thought the leader looked a bit like a Nazi, which made it even more terrifying. They just split at that point. I mean, Barney got back in the car, and they drove, and they tried to just outrun it. And later it was revealed in hypnosis that they had a memory of being stopped on the road at some point by these strange-looking creatures who pulled them out of the car and led them into the flying saucer where scary and invasive medical procedures were performed on them. But that material only came out later in hypnosis where they realized they had this period of missing time where the The trip from Montreal to New Hampshire should have taken a lot less time than it really did. And then hypnosis and psychotherapy revealed what they claimed happened to them, which is that they had been kidnapped and put in the UFO and physically had these physically invasive experiments performed on them. And they tried to, and just to sum up briefly, they kept this to themselves. They were a very private couple. They weren't the kind of folks who wanted to call a lot of attention to themselves. And eventually, after they gave a talk to a church group about it, a Boston journalist learned more about it and then wrote a longer story about it. And then they were suddenly in the public eye.
Yeah.
And then what made it even more difficult for them, they were a private couple trying to sort out what happened. It was bad enough that they were surrounded by, you know, net UFO skeptics, but they were also an interracial couple. Barney was black and Betty was white. And that added, the racial trauma added to the trauma of what happened and the trauma of trying to prove what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I did want to know how you came to write this collection about the Hills and their experience. What prompted that for you?
You know, it's I had no idea I was going to write a collection of poems about them. I had been interested in their story for a very long time. I've always had an interest in UFO phenomena, and the Hill story was part of that. I think part of the reason was that the Hills did not seem like they weren't an attention-seeking couple, and that made their story even more compelling to me. Like, they didn't ask for this to happen to them. They didn't want all the attention. And so for years, I was interested in the story. It never occurred to me to write anything about them, let alone write poems about them. But I tend to, as a poet, over my career, I tend to be drawn to subject matter that's on the margins, like arcane subject matter, strange, uncanny subject matter. I write traditional poems too, but I don't tend to be the poet who writes about, I went into my backyard and I had an epiphany when I saw a four-leaf clover, and this is a three metaphor for my life. And those are great poems. I just don't do those a lot. And I like reading those. It's just not my thing. So in 2011, I had just finished a big book project and some readings, and I was in that kind of a real open, vulnerable state to new ideas. And I thought, you know, maybe this is the time to do some more research on the Betty and Barney Hill story. And in my mind, I thought maybe I'll write a series of two or three or four poems. I was mostly interested in the time. It just writing about the strange, uncanny incident of being on the UFO, how wild it would be to write about that and try to reimagine it. But then the more I read about them, the more I became interested in all the nuances of the story. And then it became a larger book at that point.
Okay. Now, there is and I wasn't going to have you read it yet, but there is a poem about her being interviewed by Tom Snyder. And I wondered if that happened much later and you saw that as a kid, or did you not know about this as a kid?
Oh, that's great. I did not know about the Tom Snyder interview as a kid. Had I known, I would have lost my marbles in excitement. When I was a kid, I wanted to be Tom Snyder. And I know, it's like for listeners to your show who might not know Tom Snyder, I mean, I know you know who he was. He had this incredible mind where he could interview political figures on one hand and then the next night interview punk rock musicians. And he wore leisure suits, smoked incessantly, had this barking laugh.
His hair was a different color in every show.
Exactly. Sometimes it was gray. Sometimes it was brown. You know. And, so I had no idea he interviewed them. I couldn't stay up every night to watch Tom Snyder. I had to sneak around to even stay up to watch him at all because I was like 9 years old when Betty Hill was on the show. And but while I was doing research, I discovered I don't even remember the name of the person anymore. A man who had a website where he had cassette tapes of rare television, you know, Dick Cavett, selected episodes of Dick Cavett or Johnny Carson. And he had this one, and I I was able to listen to it, and it just brought me back to being 9 years old and watching that show all the time.
Yeah. I have a Tom Snyder story, but I'm going to wait and tell it to you later when we read that poem.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it.
Actually, I was wondering now if you could read the poem titled Missing Time.
Sure, absolutely. Okay. Missing Time is the first poem in the book, and very, very brief background. As I was telling the story of the hills earlier, I mentioned that they had this period where time was thrown off for them. And missing time is a common trope, cross-culturally a common trope in a lot of UFO abduction narratives, where folks who claim to have been abducted will have a kind of blackout period of anywhere from like a half hour to several hours where they just can't account for what happened during that time. And so it tends to be called missing time.
Okay.
Missing time. Her turquoise ring vanished. Pink mystery stains on her dress. Silver dollar circles scorched on the Bel Air's trunk. We can tell what happened, but this doesn't mean we know more than when we started. If David Blaine, for instance, can turn a cup of steaming coffee into a handful of coins, then it's crackpot not to believe in virgin birth or Holy Spirit. It's terrifying to think through the body. If you touch the cup of coffee, it might touch you back. The ring turned up 2 weeks later under leaves inexplicably piled on the kitchen counter. Then she started to remember the drive should have taken 4 hours.
Thank you. Thank you for reading that. That's a great introductory poem to this conversation. Yeah. I enjoyed noticing that you used 60s period language, like crackpot. That's not a word we say now anymore, right? So did you purposefully try to keep the language sort of specific to the time period?
I tried really hard. Yeah, and I really appreciate you picking up on that, because it was my hope is that readers will either pick up on it consciously like you did, or at the very least, they'll just sort of feel it unconsciously, and it'll give them a feel of being in the early 60s, give it that sense of authenticity. But I tried wherever I could to really have the people in the book inhabit me, or me inhabit them, so that I could sort of access what I thought their language would be. Yeah.
Now, but it's interesting because you do sort of interweave not a ton of your own story, but a little bit of the author is in some of the poems. There is a certain I presence that's not the hills, which is interesting. And you also interweave some sort of current events, both from the time period, but also I think a little bit from ahead of time, like David Blaine is contemporary. And so that I think leads me into asking you to talk a little bit about documentary poetry, because that you've also used a lot of research to inform the way you wrote these poems. So maybe within all of that I just said, you could find a question.
Oh, no, it's a great question, because it is really that question of, or the part about me putting the I in and putting me in the 21st century and putting the 21st century into the project is part of how I approach documentary poetics. I previously had done a book of documentary poems in 2011 called Historic Diary, which was based on Lee Harvey Oswald's diary that he kept in the Soviet Union, which he also called Historic Diary. The only person I know who named his diary title. But in that's where I first got the idea, or the felt compelled to put myself in the documentary project. Because I would show the work to other poets. I have a couple of, trusted critique groups who helped me, bring the work to the highest levels it can be. My fellow poets were saying, well, why do you want to write about Oswald's diary? Why do you want to do this? And my instinct was to say, well, you know me. I'm interested in something like that. And I thought, no, that's not what they're asking. They're asking artistically why I'm doing this. And so then I thought, well, the best way to answer that is to actually write poems where I'm trying to figure that out. So in that first book, I'm trying to figure out, why am I interested in this project? Why am I doing it? And as I did that, as I began to write those poems, I realized, oh, this is the key to something that had been really bugging me. Like I was working on this documentary project with Oswald, and I did not want my subject matter to feel, I didn't want to feel like I was putting a barrier between myself and my subject matter. I didn't want to feel like the people in the book were like specimens in a history exhibit or something, a natural history exhibit. You know, I didn't want them to be like objects.
Right.
I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to break down that separation between the two of us. And it helped me with that book. And then especially with this book, Proof Something Happened, I felt like the hills were so horribly objectified by mainstream media, by, you know, racists in their town who would paint swastikas on the driveways, you know, on the driveway, stuff like that, that they had enough, they took enough garbage from people that I thought they don't need someone writing about them and then objectifying them like they're exhibits in a natural history museum. So that intensified the need to put myself in it, to blur the boundary between myself and them so that the book is about them, but it's also about me trying to write about them and trying to write ethically about them. Mm-hmm. So that was the effort to just sort of like, you know, implicate myself, I guess, in the journey as much as anybody else.
Yeah. Okay. Tony, how about, would you mind now reading They Were All Dressed Alike, Betty Wasn't Really Prepared for Their Appearance?
Sure, sure. So, and that title is, there are a number of poems in the book that have these sort of longer titles. It's part of an effort to create a particularly strange atmosphere for the poems that might match how strange it was for Betty and Barney Hill.
Yeah.
This is a poem where I'm trying to imagine what it was like for the two of them to be in the spaceship and imagine what it was like to have these medical procedures performed and to have their personal physical boundaries violated. Mm-hmm. and to write about it and capture the fear of that. One of the things that Betty mentioned was that the aliens were absolutely fascinated with her feet. And so that was sort of the trigger point for this poem.
Okay.
They were all dressed alike. Betty wasn't really prepared for their appearance. Tracked by still light, the slow burning me. You hover, a halo struck like chalk over the operating table. Your eyes blackening, soupy and lucid. Nostril slits, two clove bulbs hovering over the mouth. Pianist fingers and needlessly gray. The sterile pressure of white smoke and ash around my ribs. You become undone. The crooked red lifelines on the bottoms of my feet. Too many of you cracking the nave of my arches. Least thing of my feet, and you can't take your hands off them. Star travelers have a lot to learn, stretching my heels between their fingers, cherishing them. Tones struck in the swarm of those fingers.
Wow, thank you. I love the line, pianist fingers and needlessly gray. That's such an interesting juxtaposition of images. It's like their fingers are very long and gray, but I like the way that they're sort of needlessly gray. And I was curious.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and I was curious about the focus on her feet. And it also made me wonder if, and, you know, again, I'm not going to say allegedly, I'm just going to go ahead and talk about this collection as a collection. But if the aliens, let's say, in the collection, were at all aware of the difference in their race, you know, in their races, Barney's and Betty's, you know, they're studying them so closely, but was there ever in any of the... in any of the documentation, any sense that they had noticed that, for example?
Yeah, that's really fascinating. The sense I got from the research was that that wasn't something that the aliens cared a whole heck of a lot about. I think it was, they were doing a kind of inventory, a scientific inventory, you could almost look at it that way, of the hills. And they seemed a lot more interested in biological function. At one point, they had Barney's false teeth, and they were utterly fascinated with his false teeth. The common verb we use for that common verb that's used in UFO abduction narratives is, you know, probe, being probed. And the hills were invaded. They were certainly probed, which I would look at as an assault, you know, and they were physically assaulted. And it really felt like the, and this is just my impressionistic experience from the research, that the aliens were looking at the hills like another species and treating them, treating them roughly and looking for internal biological, physical differences more than questions of color and pigmentation like we would be doing on Earth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that needlessly gray is interesting in that context, too. So,
yeah.
Not relevant.
The fact that they're coming off as gray, and then, as I say later, they're portrayed in a movie as blue.
Right.
I know.
It's interesting. So you have I'm not quite sure what this was, if it's a blurb or if it's a quote by a judge. This book won the Marsh Hawk Press Poetry Prize from 2020, but Cole Swenson said that this collection is a stunning example of poetry's ability to access the unsayable. And I loved that description of this poetry, but also about poetry's ability to handle a story like this one. And I wonder if you want to just talk a little bit about that.
That's great. Of all the blurbs, that moment where Cole Swenson talks about the unsayable, it was one that really just, I loved all the blurbs. They were amazing. I was so honored by them.
Yeah.
And that moment where Cole Swenson talks about the unsayable really, really sort of pushed the buttons of my own poetics in a very nice way. So I'm glad you asked about that.
Yeah.
For me, that's the essence of art in general, but especially poetry, because it's language based, that the idea that I turn to poems as a reader and as a writer to try to, as Cole says, access the unsayable. My favorite poems are the ones that put in language what I feel can't be put into words at all. And for me, that goes back to, and this is interestingly a kind of a connection to the hills experience that I would have never dreamed of as a child. But when I was a kid, like a really small child, you know, 6, 7 years old, my first real encounter with poetic language was in some ways lyrics, song lyrics, my brother or my sister's Beatles albums, but also in a way that rattled me a little bit more, it was the children's Bible that I was reading, the stories from the Hebrew Bible and the Christian New Testament. And I was really struck by, you know, like the stories of Ezekiel, you know, and the chariot he sees in the sky and the wind, the real rims with eyes. And I was really struck by all the prophets' stories, but especially Ezekiel's, where it was like the prophets had to speak in a really, they spoke in what would come off as a very strange poetic language because there was no words to describe what they were experiencing. And my favorite poems do that for me. Even the joke I made earlier about, you know, the poet who goes into their backyard and has an epiphany with a four-leaf clover, like, I don't want to put that down because those are moments where, like, the four-leaf clover expresses something you couldn't put into words. And those are my favorite moments in poems, you know? So that, like, part of my poetics, where I want the poem to say the unsayable, or at least try to say the unsayable. As I was working on this book, I realized I was digging deeper into that idea more than I probably had in any other collection. I was, with every poem, I was trying to find a way to say something that it felt we had no words for, you know, the encounter with an otherworldly, a literal other from another world. Like, how do you even begin to talk about that? And that was part of what's really fun about the book, but that was also what, what could be frustrating at times writing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, great. I understand you're a musician as well. Is that right?
Yes, I've been a drummer and percussionist since I was about 12, and I play the banjo a little bit, but more slowly than one should play the banjo. I'm not that adept. Yeah, but I've been a professional drummer at times, and yeah.
Do you write songs as well?
Yeah, and the band I'm in now, we released an EP right before, self-produced EP right before the pandemic hit, and one of the songs was one of the poems in this book that we put to music, and I sort of did voiceover for the lyrics. So yeah, I contribute to the songwriting too, and sometimes with some bands contribute with lyrics, yeah.
What's the name of the band?
Bummer Deluxe.
Okay.
Deluxe has an E on it, a sort of like fancy deluxe. Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we've come to my Tom Snyder story. So
all right.
About 2 weeks after I graduated from high school, I decided I was going to stay up really late. It was, you know, the Tom Snyder show was called The Tomorrow Show because it started after midnight, after The Tonight Show. And I wanted to watch it because Sidney Sheldon was going to be on. And I was really curious to see what Sidney Sheldon was like. So I stayed up late and I was watching The Tom Snyder Show. And all of a sudden, I noticed out my bedroom window that it was bright, like light, like daylight. And I was like, what's going on? And my house was on fire. And
oh, my God.
Yeah. And I've always sort of thought that Tom Snyder's show saved my life. Now, probably we would have figured it out anyway, but just that's my Tom Snyder story.
I love, you know, I would say the same thing. Like, well, we probably would have figured it out, but I also want to think that Tom Snyder chain smoking with that big laugh, he alerted me to the fire. I would be thinking the same thing.
That's right. I know, right? I should totally write a poem about that. We should do a poetry collection where we like solicit poems about Tom Snyder.
Oh my God. I would swoon. I'd be like, I want to write all of them. No, I probably, this might be the one in the book, might be the only Tom Snyder poem I have in me, who knows, but gosh, I loved that show. It was so great.
So maybe now you could read October 23rd, 1975, Tom Snyder interviews Betty Hill on The Tomorrow Show.
My pleasure. There's really nothing else to say in background. We've talked about Tom Snyder. Maybe the only other thing is that one of the things I'm trying to do in this poem, you know, we talked earlier about bringing myself into the documentary project. In doing so, I knew that I had to bring my family in, and you know, I love my family, but my family is just generally racist, and it was a very difficult kind of environment to grow up in, and I'm estranged from a number of family members because of that. So it was, in some ways, this poem was a total delight to write because I got to write it. I gave myself permission to write about Tom Snyder. And in other ways, it was hard because I had to really like face the family racism. All right. October 23rd, 1975, Tom Snyder interviews Betty Hill on The Tomorrow Show. TV producers wanted an all-black or all-white couple to play the Hills parts. Betty held out until 1975, when Universal decided to cast black actor James Earl Jones as Barney and Estelle Parsons, who's white, to play Betty. It was the year of the most famous World Series in history, and Betty's Red Sox won Game 6. The one baseball historians call an epic, which in their lingo really does mean a long poem, a tale of the tribe. And I stayed up until 12:30, riveted by my idol, portly, cigar-puffing Red Sox pitcher Louis Tiant, El Tiante, Cuban exile. My family approved. In their immigrant anxiety, comparing the number of white players to black, Tiant, as a Cuban, was not really black, didn't count in the tabulation. No one allowed for the possibility that Sicilians could be dark as El Tiante. I could wager my stupid ball player idolizing heart on his tired arm and walrus mustache, and for a change, my brother wouldn't punch me for being a race traitor. The producers flew Betty to New York. A private screening and an appearance on Tom Snyder's Tomorrow Show the night of Game 7. I dare say, Snyder dared to say, buzzing with hyperbole as always, a cigarette between his fingers as always. If anybody had gone to an EKG machine after the Boston and Cincinnati game last night, there might have been a few peaks and valleys in the electrocardiogram report. Actually, most fans in the Eastern time zone, like me, went straight to bed after Game 6. Tom asked how neighbors treated them afterward. Did people think old Betty and old Barney had just, you know, gone over the hill? That the pilot light is gone? NBC played Paul McCartney and Wings, Venus and Mars Are All Right Tonight, before each commercial segment. A song I listened to, my portable cassette player, which I carried around like the teddy bear I'd outgrown, while doing spelling homework. The problem is the little stories that get in the way, Tom said. Like the fellow in Wisconsin who had 14 million little men and women in bushel baskets in his basement who were going to take him and his wife away after Christmas until the end of the world. You have to shift out all the ding-a-lings and bushel baskets in basements. Someone in Portsmouth painted a swastika on their sidewalk, splattered their car with eggs. The aliens, she said, were not colorblind television executives. Abduction itself isn't good enough for them. Sometimes they're forced to cast interracial couples in made-for-TV movies.
Thank you very much for that one. And I want to mention that poem is, it's all sort of one column of poetry with a single line break between Race Traitor and The Producers Flew Betty to New York. I was curious about the line break. Did you sort of literally need a little break after that personal story? It struck me.
Yeah, but that's part of it. Like I wanted the poem to have skinny lines so that it'd have a kind of boxed in claustrophobic feel. And I wanted that to be kind of a contrast to the kookiness of Tom Snyder. He's saying these kooky things, but Betty Hill's like, you know, they painted a swastika on her sidewalk, so it's not as kooky for her. So I wanted that contrast. And when I got to that part about Race Traitor, I think in the back of my mind, I wanted to catch my breath and I wanted a bit of a break. And so that's why I initially broke the line there, broke the stanza there. But when I was revising the poem, I kept it I kept that as the only break because I felt like, oh, I want the reader to have just like an extra beat of a break, like a silence in a piece of music, just to digest that and collect their thoughts for like a nanosecond before they move on.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. I liked the line, I dare say, Snyder dared to say. And it reminded us, and then later we're not reading this one, but there's another poem in the collection where Betty chided her captors for performing medical tests on her nerves. Such nerve. And it's like, I did enjoy that throughout. You're telling a story, but you're also playing with language, and it's kind of fun.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah. I'm usually kind of extra neurotic about not repeating words that way, but those moments were moments where I wanted to have that repetition. I wanted the effect to come out. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a really good point. It's like accidentally repeating words is not good. Not to be too like, and purposefully repeating words can be very interesting and creative, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Like I can see the shaping hand of the writer underneath that. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Now, I do like to ask people who I'm interviewing if they have read anything by anybody else, one or two titles that you enjoyed that you might recommend to listeners.
Oh, yeah. So a couple things I've been reading recently. I've been rereading a book of poems by Maureen Seaton, called Genetics. Uh-huh. It came out in 2014, but it's being re-released this year, or next year, I think. And so I've been rereading Maureen's book. It's this collection of really zany, exuberant and zany are the words I'd use for Marie, poems, the sort of origin stories that kind of fit the title, Genetics. I've been reading that. I've also been rereading Harriet Mullen's book of Tanka poems called Urban Tumbleweed. These really wonderful haiku-like poems that are like nature-based, urban-based, and also political. I've also been reading this book by a younger poet. Her name is Diamond Ford, F-O-R-D-E. It's called Mother Body. We published some of her poems in a magazine I co-edited, Cork Green, last year, and I just really loved the poems. And I bought the book when it came out recently, and I'm planning on teaching it in the fall. So I'm kind of immersed in that too. I'm also reading a science fiction book by Arkady Martin called A Memory Called Empire. But it's, I don't read as much contemporary science fiction as I would like, and so this was it was given to me as a gift by my cousin and his wife, and I love it so far. So I'm kind of always reading a number of books at once.
Yeah, that's great. What are you writing now? Are you writing new stuff right now?
Yeah, I'm doing a couple big. The biggest things right now, I'm doing this fourth book in a multi-volume project that probably will take another 10 years and four or five books to finish. It's called The Complete Dark Shadows of My Childhood. And when I was a kid, I used to watch the vampire soap opera Dark Shadows with my mother. And I'm rewatching every episode of the show on DVD. And I write one sentence in response to each episode. And then I also use that sentence as a conduit for autobiographical material. So it's kind of like a memoir through bad television, for lack of a better word. And it's a cross between poetry and prose. And I'm in the middle of book four right now. And it's a lot of prose poems and then a lot of like regular looking verse poems. So I'm really in the thick of that. Probably will finish book four hopefully around this time next year. And then the other big project I'm doing, when we were in production for the new book that we're talking about, Proof Something Happened, the publisher, Marsh Hawk Press, asked me if I'd be interested in doing a craft memoir for this series of craft-based memoirs that they're doing. And so I'm doing that right now. That's been a big project this summer. I'm writing a lot of, I guess you could say, origin stories about my work and my writing and trying to sort of tell the stories in a way that they could start really good discussions of craft and technique for readers. And it's like nothing I've written before, and it's been a lot of fun to
tell
great. A lot of these old stories. Yeah,
wow, you got a lot going on.
Yeah, so I said yes to a lot of things in the pandemic.
Yeah.
But it's all fun stuff. I'm really loving what I'm doing, so it's good. Yeah.
Okay, great. So Tony, I always like to finish these interviews by asking for some advice for listeners who are writers. Mm-hmm. And in your case, I thought I would ask for advice for tackling docu-poetry if one has never tried it or perhaps even heard of it. If you have different advice you'd like to give, that's absolutely your prerogative. But I thought that I'd start there.
Yeah, you know, that's great. That's a great question. There's a part of my mind that wants to give you 300 answers, but that would be here too long. So I'm trying to coalesce them into like one big answer. But I guess the most important thing would be for advice for folks who are interested in docu-poetry would be to try to be equally as interested in official historical documents as in unofficial historical documents. And by that, I mean, like, you want to be, as a docu-poet, you want to be focused on the truth, and you're doing a documentary, so you're invested in truth-telling. So naturally, you want to go to, like, government documents or journalistic sources and history books. You should definitely, and I go to those, and you should definitely go to those. But I've also found that writing docu-poetry, it's just as important to go to the more subjective kinds of things, like people's diaries and the letters they were writing to friends or their emails that they were writing, just kind of like those things that we write when we're uninhibited, I'm writing a letter to a friend, I'm not worried about what I'm going to say. And that reveals a lot about what's going on in my life. It's very uncensored. And so you get a kind of uncensored, unofficial history from diaries and journals. And then you get the official history, which is important and also its own, sometimes sanitized. And so for me, the advice might be to try, if one is working in that mode, to try to combine both of those modes of history, the unofficial and the official, as much as possible.
Oh, that sounds great. I think that's really helpful. And I must admit, I'm not really familiar with docu-poetry, but I think that that would be very helpful advice if I were to try and tackle it, because I think I would be tempted to kind of go to the official sources and try to mix those in with my own thoughts, which might be the creative side. And I wouldn't even necessarily be thinking about the more subjective documentation, which would bring like a whole nother level of interest. So I think that's great. Thank you.
Oh, great. Thanks. Yeah.
So I want to mention again that the book is called Proof Something Happened, winner of the 2020 Marsh Hawk Press Poetry Prize and published by Marsh Hawk Press. And I've been speaking with the author, Tony Trujillo. Tony, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks, Shelley. This was really great. Thank you very much.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Tony Trujillo about his new book, Proof Something Happened, selected by Susan Howe as winner of the 2020 Marsh Hawk Press Poetry Prize and published by Marsh Hawk Press. You can learn more about his work at starve.org, starve.org. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Tony Trujillo. The prompt is adapted from a book called The Zen of Creativity, Cultivating Your Artistic Life by John Daido Lurie. Sit with an object, memory, experience, until it begins to reveal itself to you, its details, contours, emotions, and so on. Be open to the possibility that you might need to sit for a long time. As you get more comfortable with the object's familiar contours, the odd, strange, subtle, mysterious, and absurd, and equally as real aspects of this object of your mind will reveal themselves. Express these in a poem, any form, shape, structure, tone, or pitch. You are writing about what else the object is, and likely also writing about what is not. Like a painter working with negative space, this approach can help you discover the fullest sense of your subject matter. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. The pandemic is not over. We are definitely not out of the woods. Many people are still at risk, like children who are too young for the vaccines. And so wearing a mask, even if you are vaccinated, may again be asked of you. Given the variants that we've found popping up around the world and various ways in which it's very clear we're not out of the woods yet, this is a pretty simple request, in my opinion. It's also an opportunity to be generous and a good way to support each other, like waving somebody into traffic, even if it's not their turn, so that traffic keeps flowing and the system keeps working. So another way to support each other is to try to find the books that have come out during the pandemic. Authors who have worked for years on their books are facing anticlimactic launches and uncertain book tours, so let's find their books and do what we can to get the word out about them. For your own part, I hope that you are able to read and to write. Keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work, just like today's prompt by my guest, Tony Trujillo. And very often, the prompts are by my guests, and I credit them for it, or I come up with something. And actually, if anybody ever wants to email me with prompt ideas, I do use them if listeners send them to me. It's kind of fun when that happens. Okay, I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to speak to certain authors, or if you have events to announce about things that are taking place in your own venue, things that are taking place about your own books, things that are taking place about friends' books or favorite authors' books. If you like the show, please rate it where you get your podcasts. Like it on Facebook, talk about it, tweet about it. Please tell your friends about Write the Book and the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, lots of other podcast sites. And then you can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.